Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. U.S. News and World Report's out with a big cover story this week, and it's one of those we really need to talk about. It's on sex education in teenagers. And as I have suggested to you several times over, this is one of those issues that will recur again and again and again, because the culture war, our cultural conflict, really comes down to how we're going to envision the most basic issues of life. And, of course, human sexuality is at the center of that, and our teenagers, adolescents, our children are the focus of the political, the policy question: what is to be taught in sex education? Of course, the primary arena here is the public schools, but there are larger ramifications that will reach virtually all Americans. We're going to talk to you about what's in this cover story, what it reveals, and why it's important. And we're going to join you, ask you to join the conversation. We're going to allow you to express what you believe about this, the proper role of sex education, its content, and proper focus. The phone number will be 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, to review some issues in the news. The Nobel Prizes are awarded this time of the year, and of course there are already announcements out in terms of chemistry and physics and many other of the prizes. But just yesterday, the Swedish Academy announced the 2005 Nobel Prize in Literature. And this year it has been awarded to British playwright Harold Pinter. Now, when I heard this, I was genuinely shocked. First of all, because it's been a long time since I've heard of Harold Pinter. This was one of those men who was really very much avant-garde in the 60s and 70s. He's now in his 70s, as a matter of fact, and the Swedish Academy is making quite a statement in choosing Harold Pinter. I can remember when I was a teenager and I first became familiar with Harold Pinter plays. They are of the theater of the absurd. They say very little. They are non sequiturs. As a matter of fact, it was the critic Mark Steyn who described what it means to be Pinter-esque. That is, he described Pinter's style of playwriting as a pause followed by a non sequitur. In other words, it's nonsense. But it's not just nonsense. It is politically laden nonsense. For the last several years, the Swedish Academy has been intentionally awarding the prizes, for instance, in literature, to those on the political left. And there is an open and undisguised antipathy towards the United States and towards traditional values and all the rest. And the Nobel Prizes, well, you can look back and see that they were once awarded on the basis of very clear and convincing literary ability. But really not now. I just cannot imagine that from any standard, fair, objective literary evaluation, Harold Pinter would deserve this prize. On his own personal website, he says this: "In 1958, I wrote the following: there are no hard distinctions between what is real and what is unreal, nor between what is true and what is false. A thing is not necessarily either true or false. It can be both true and false. I believe that these assertions will make sense and do still apply to the exploration of reality through art. So as a writer, I stand by them, but as a citizen, I cannot. As a citizen, I must ask what is true, what is false," end quote. Now, how can any sane person write that? I don't believe that any sane person can mean that and remain sane. You can't say that there is no such thing as truth, and I insist that I know the truth. He says, as a writer, I don't believe that there is any such thing as truth, and he goes on to say that a thing can be both true and false. Ladies and gentlemen, that's impossible. A thing cannot be both true and false. That is the kind of absurdity that gave the theater of the absurd its name. But Mr. Pinter is way out there on the political left, and like so many before him, he has gone on to undermine truth and then to claim that he knows it simultaneously. In response to the terrorist attacks of September 11, Harold Pinter said, quote, "The atrocity in New York was predictable and inevitable. It was an act of retaliation against constant and systematic manifestations of state terrorism on the part of the United States over many years in all parts of the world," end quote. You know, I remember when I first started reading Francis Schaeffer, one of the great apologists of the 20th century, a great evangelist to an entire intellectual class of young people. Francis Schaeffer himself probably influenced thousands and thousands of searching young people during the 60s and the 70s and during the 80s. I was one of those. I grew up in a very fine church, but there were questions that I was really struggling with, and it was Francis Schaeffer who really helped me to understand this through his writings and to face many of these issues. And Francis Schaeffer talked about the inconsistency of the postmodern mind. He talked about a figure like Jean-Paul Sartre, the most significant existentialist philosopher of the 20th century. Sartre, like Harold Pinter, said there is no such thing as truth. There is no such thing as meaning. He was a nihilist in the midst of his existentialism. And yet, during the conflict in France over the colonial question and over Algeria, he sided with the Algerian independence movement, saying this is a just cause. Ladies and gentlemen, if there is no meaning, if there is no truth, then it's impossible to say that this cause is just rather than that cause, that this position is right rather than that position. One of the key tests of any worldview is whether it can be applied consistently. And Harold Pinter's worldview of the theater of the absurd can't be applied consistently. You can't say there is no truth and then say that you know the truth and this is over here the truth and that is not. Roger Kimball got it just right. The Nobel Prize Committee long ago demonstrated that its prizes for the arts were exercises in politically correct sermonizing. By choosing Harold Pinter, they have demonstrated that their sermons are ridiculous as well as repellent. The future of atheism is a big question, and I blog on that. You can find it at my site, albertmohler.com. I'm looking at an article by Ronald Aronson published in the most current issue of Book Forum. Ronald Aronson looks at a series of books by and atheists and about atheism, and he goes on to say that atheism appears to be on the defensive. Now, by the way, I agree with that, at least in part. I think that secularism is on the ascendancy. That is to say that the secularist spirit is growing across the world, especially in Western countries. But ideological atheism is on pretty shaky ground. Now, Ronald Aronson appears to bemoan that, and he's celebrating the rise of some young atheists. He calls them the new atheists, but he has a very interesting twist. He says that the older atheism that appeared to be on the rise during the 19th century was an atheism that was imbued with hope. Hope about progress, hope about the future, about human nature and human capacity. And he says that now atheism has lost that hope. And he suggests that if these new atheists are to recapture the cultural momentum, they're going to have to come up with some kind of atheistic hope. As a Christian theologian, folks, when I hear that kind of argument, I just have to smile. Where in the world is an atheist going to ground hope? Where in the world are they going to try to come up with some kind of hope? You know, the 20th century effectively put the veto, the nullification, on the idea of human progress. The idea that human beings are basically good and getting better and better. The very idea that you could ground a spirit of hope, a confidence of optimism in human beings. Well, the 20th century is the great refutation of that theory. But that'll be an interesting question. Where in the world do these new atheists think that they will ground hope? There's a lot of talk about this new flu, the bird flu, and the potential that that this could become a new pandemic. I wrote about that several months ago on one of my commentaries, and right now it's become a renewed hot topic. And it's not only the fact that this new avian bird flu is showing up in Europe with documented cases now of the worst strains in Turkey, and reportedly also perhaps in Bulgaria, but it's also the fact that American scientists have reconstituted the Spanish flu of the pandemic of 1918. Charles Krauthammer in today's townhall.com goes on to say that this is a scientific achievement of staggering proportions, but he also says that it is a terrifying and close moral call. What in the world will we do with the fact that we can now reconstitute these awful plagues? Will scientists decide that they will put back together through genetic engineering the Black Plague, the bubonic plague, and other illnesses that have decimated humanity? What will we do with that knowledge? What if this knowledge falls into the wrong hands? Folks, the brave new world in which we're living is not just about human cloning and embryonic stem cell research and transgenic experimentations and transhumanism. It's also about the evil side of the potential use of medicine. If these viruses can be reconstituted by American scientists in American laboratories for the cause of medical science, they can also be reconstituted by others and used for nefarious plots. You know, just recently a friend and I were looking at a documentary dealing with the Second World War and the revelation that the Japanese government, the government of Imperial Japan, had planned to use biological warfare against the United States. Had the war not ended in August of 1945, there is good reason to believe that the Japanese would have launched biological weapons against San Diego and other West Coast cities. Operation Dark Cloud. Well, folks, you look at this and you realize that the humanity is capable of incredible evil. Now, isn't that exactly what Jean-Paul Sartre was denying and affirming simultaneously? Isn't that our answer to the Harold Pinters, that there is a truth? And the truth is that there are really evil acts, inherently, objectively wrong decisions. Isn't it far more honest and far more healthy to face the true nature of what it means to be human, and then to point to the only solution, which is redemption through Jesus Christ? The Christian worldview points to the solution and understands the problem. We'll be right back to talk about a Christian understanding of the sex education crisis, coast to coast. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back, folks. No doubt you have seen, at least many of you have seen, the cover story of this week's U.S. News and World Report. It's a pretty compelling article on sex education, how teens learn about intimacy, what schools should do. Now, folks, when a major American news magazine puts out a cover story like this, it becomes one of those opportunities and catalysts for cultural conversation. We know the very fact that this article exists means that some of our friends and neighbors are talking about this. Many people are reading it. There aren't very many news avenues that compel a lot of cultural conversation, but the Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, they have the ability to really set something of a conversation agenda for America, and especially among those who read. And this is one of those articles that requires reading. I want to commend it to you. It's available on the website of U.S. News and World Report. I'll put that up on my blog so that you can find it in just a matter of hours. But let me tell you, the big take home from this article is that we're in trouble when it comes to sex education. We've dealt with controversies in Montgomery County, Maryland. We've dealt with controversies in school districts from Florida to California and in Pennsylvania and beyond. But the reality is that wherever there is public education, there is almost sure to be controversy. Now, there's a political background to this. In 1981, Congress adopted the Adolescent Family Life Act that gave money to educational programs that would promote self-discipline and other prudent approaches. Then in 1996, in the Welfare Reform Act, Congress established a federal program to fund exclusively abstinence-only curricula, then giving an incentive to school districts to adopt that model of sex education. But U.S. News and World Report is making some astounding claims in this article. They claim that 35% of public school districts offer the abstinence-only program, that 14% offer a comprehensive program. I'm going to talk about what that means, and 51% abstinence-plus. Let's define terms here for just a moment. Abstinence-only sex education means that the facts of human reproduction and puberty and development and adolescence and sexuality are presented, but with a clear message that the only proper exercise of sexual activity is within marriage. Abstinence only means that those that are leading the program supposedly say that it is better that one wait until marriage to have sex, but if you do not, then here's backup in terms of information on contraception, birth control, etc. The other comprehensive, well, you just notice the propaganda value of using the word comprehensive. I mean, after all, if you ask a parent, do you believe in a comprehensive model of education about any subject, they're going to say yes, because it sounds rather defensive to say, no, I don't want a comprehensive program of sex education. But let me tell you, I don't want one. And I'll tell you why. It's because what is called comprehensive sex education is sex education that can comprehend, that is, can include virtually everything and anything, including the kind of approach that would normalize homosexuality, same-sex marriage, that would get into matters of sexual technique and in-depth knowledge about contraception and birth control methodologies. These are the kind of programs that use cucumbers and show how to use condoms. It's really the kind of stuff that will curl the hair of parents just as they look at this kind of thing. It will certainly reach your heart rate. I can guarantee you that. The U.S. News cover story begins with Joshua Lennon, a high school freshman, who said to his dad, hey, Dad, they gave me an ATM card in health class today. The ATM stands for Abstinence Till Marriage. And Joshua Lennon and his mom and dad think that is just the right approach. But immediately in this news story, you are introduced to parents Ed Gold and Amy Robinson, who have a very different approach. Robinson, that is Amy Robinson, the wife mother in this marriage, says, what if they can't just say no? What if they're overwhelmed, or they think they are in love, or their bodies overrule their heads? The reality is that children are having sexual experiences younger and younger. I don't understand the concept of not wanting the child to have all the available information. I don't think that's any way to make a child whole. Now, Amy Robinson appears later in this article as well, but I got to tell you, there's some stuff in here that I think will shock parents, such as this. In terms of the kind of approach that you will find in some of these comprehensive programs, one of those that leads a program called Sex Etc., she says that this kind of comprehensive program should include all kinds of things. Let me just read to you from the article. An ideal sex education program. Now, folks, warning, you're going to find this shocking. An ideal sex education curriculum would include learning about romantic relationships and the different things you can do to prevent actual intercourse but still be romantic, like taking a bath together, sleeping in the same bed together, and just cuddling, watching a romantic movie, or just being alone and discovering what they believe is romantic without being sexually active. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let's have a little bit of honesty here. This is obviously redefining sexually active. What it means is anything short of intercourse. Not that intercourse is wrong, they would be glad to say. Not that teens should be told not to have intercourse until marriage. Just that they should not have intercourse until they are ready. Don't you love that explanation? But if being sexually active does not include taking a bath together and sleeping in the same bed together, I have to wonder whether reality is even a close neighbor to this concept. Let me tell you, when you encourage two teenagers to take a bath together, you are encouraging them to be sexually active. One of the big questions, and in fact the central question posed by the U.S. News and World Report cover story is this, and the magazine puts it explicitly in these terms. Are we teaching our kids too much about sex or too little? I want to know what you think about this. Are we, and that means through sex education programs, teaching our kids too much or too little? How do you as parents engage this issue? To what extent do you expect the schools to teach sex education? I don't believe one statistic that's in this book, that is in this cover story. This cover story says that only 15% of parents want an abstinence-only sex education curriculum. They say that only 15% want an abstinence-only approach. That means that 85% want something other than an abstinence-only approach. You know, either I'm living among people who are very unusual, or they're just dead wrong in this statistic. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Are we, U.S. News and World Report asks, are we giving kids too much information or too little in sex education? What would you expect out of a sex education program, and how would you as parents respond to some of these redefinitions, reformulations, some of these curricular suggestions, such that we should teach teenagers that they don't have to have intercourse, they can take a bath together, or they can sleep in the same bed together, or just cuddle and find out what it means to be romantic without being, quote, sexually active. Ladies and gentlemen, take it from one who remembers at least partially what it was like to be a teenager. That would mean being sexually active. Who is fooling whom? Well, the American taxpayer is being asked to pay for this. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. You may say, well, my kids aren't a part of this because we homeschool or we send our children to Christian schools. And God bless you. I'm thankful for you and your children that this isn't an issue for you. But it is an issue for your family because it really matters what those around you are being taught, what the peers of your children are being taught, and what kind of sexual morality is setting the norm for the civilization in which we live. It's a missiological question for Christians. How do we respond to persons who have this kind of an understanding of sexuality? How do we respond in terms of meeting the challenge of communicating Christian truth and a biblical understanding of sex and sexuality in a world that's embracing this kind of, well, I'll just call it lunacy? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Folks, this is reality. This cover story. This is about what is happening in actual school districts. I wonder how many parents actually know what their children are being taught. The phone number, 877-893-8255, coast to coast. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This USU News and World Report cover story on sex education is a real eye-opener, and the organizations and websites that are mentioned in the article will simply blow your mind. One is a curricular program that is offered by the Unitarian Universalist Association. It's known by its acronym OWL, which stands for Our Whole Lives. And folks, let's just say it wasn't what I was taught in Sunday school, I can tell you that. And then the website By Teenagers for Teenagers, and don't you know that would be a good way to communicate sex education? It's entitled Sex Etc. I cannot possibly read you much of what is on that website. That is the way teenagers are communicating with other teenagers in a way that is commended by many of these proponents of comprehensive sex education. It's comprehensive in a whole new way. Let's go to Scott calling from Cleveland, Ohio, listening to WHKW. Scott, welcome.
Hey, Doctor.
What do you think of all this?
I was just listening to what you were talking about there, and just now caught the fact that it came out of the Unitarian Universalism Church program. That's sort of self-explanatory in itself.
Yes, it is.
When you said that, I went, well, no wonder. But I know that as a young man, the last thing in the world my mother or my father would ever allowed me to have done was hop into a tub without any clothes on with a girl. Because they know the last thing going through my mind would be avoiding sex.
Yeah, you know, how do you make sense of this, Scott? I mean, these are intelligent people. I mean, they're able to write curriculum. I mean, they obviously have a point, but, you know, don't you think the real issue here is that they're really just redefining sex?
They do have a point, but it's not sex abstinence, okay?
Yeah.
You know anything about the Unitarian Universalist Church? It has very little to do with Christianity. They call themselves a church. I'm not quite sure what they're a church of.
Yeah, well, by the very fact that both Unitarian and Universalist are in the name, that's true. But, you know, the issue of the baths and everything actually didn't come out of their curriculum, but out of a sex ed program that was promoted by some of these comprehensive sex education proponents. The Unitarian Universalist stuff comes up because their own curriculum is being taught in Sunday school and their churches. You know, it's being held up, Scott, as an example of the fact that, for instance, religious people, that's the way you put it, because I couldn't refer to that movement as Christian, nor would it any longer. But those religious people are disagreeing on this, and I think that's one of our challenges. Thanks for your call, Scott. Let's go to Pam calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Pam, what do you think? All right, we lost Pam. Let's go to Maureen calling from Manchester, Connecticut, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Maureen, how do you figure all this?
I am not surprised at what was in the article because of the loose morals and values that I feel that this nation has. I'm shocked, but just not surprised, not at all. I agree that abstinence should be taught, and I don't know if we're ever going to get there.
Now, Maureen, are you a parent? Are you thinking of your own kids or your own experience as a parent here?
Yes, I am. I do have a 16-year-old daughter, and I believe that with the media and different things going on, this baby is inundated with all types of sexual images, so they just want to, you know, make sure that these kids have proper protection and things like that. No one is concerned about upholding the morals and values of the Bible and waiting until marriage.
Okay,
and it's hard to counter that.
Maureen, I want to ask you an honest, straightforward question. And this may identify you. I'm going to out you here as a seriously radical person, I think. Do you actually expect your daughter to refrain from all sexual activity until marriage?
In my heart, I would like her to do that, but whether or not she is another story.
Yes, but what I'm saying is, are you teaching her that that is your expectation?
I am. Indeed, I am. Indeed, I am. That is the best way to do things. Yes, indeed. But I'm just concerned that she may not be hearing me because of all the other voices that are around her and things like this.
Yeah, well, Maureen, let me tell you, I think that you can have confidence that if you'll spend time honestly talking with her and you'll lay out the case and be very clear and unequivocal about your expectations, you can instill in her a resilience and a defense mechanism that other kids don't have. But don't waver, don't back up, and don't offer any back door here. Just be absolutely biblically firm in terms of your Christian convictions, and don't waver. Folks, the phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. U.S. News and World Report is asking, are we giving our kids too much information? or too little. There are people on both sides of this controversy. Folks, there are those who think that comprehensive sex education isn't comprehensive enough. I was looking the other day at some of this literature, and the person writing this particular article said that the last thing we need to do is give kids any reason for guilt in terms of their sexual choices. Well, folks, you know, that's not only just pure moral insanity. You can't even apply that. You know, why just teenagers? Would you say that of adults? Of course not. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This issue of sex education is sure to interest a lot of parents, and I think it should. One of my concerns is that that we as Christians are not thinking about this, not so much at the level of public policy, where, of course, we need to direct our thoughts, but in the level of our own families, our own children, and our own responsibility to deal with these issues. You know, I think we even have to talk about this issue, that is the abstract issue of sex education, with our kids as we talk to them about sex. I think they need to know that some kids are being taught very different things than they're being taught at home. I think they need to be prepared for the clash of worldviews at an age-appropriate stage, in which they're going to be facing people their own age whose ideas about sex and sexuality are so very different than their own, so very different than what they have been taught. You know, it is a real disservice to kids to send them out with them thinking that all others are going to agree with them. And if they've been taught a comprehensively, truthfully, a legitimately Christian understanding of sexuality, they're going to find themselves in a decided minority in many circles. The phone number, folks, to join this conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to John, listening on XM Satellite Radio in Somerset, Pennsylvania. Welcome, John.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you.
Yeah, I just read a book called Home Invasion that was very enlightening on this subject. And the biggest thing they talked about was we need to start teaching our kids at a very early age, because that's where the TV and the media is trying to teach them about sex. And I think the biggest thing is, though, that we have to know as parents what our school is teaching, and that we have the right to opt them out of those classes.
Now, John, I just want to come back at you for a minute here. I appreciate what you're suggesting. And by the way, we've had Rebecca Hagelin as a guest on this program to talk about her book, Home Invasion. When you talk about parents having this responsibility and opting out, do you think many parents even know that they can do this?
No, absolutely not. It's something the school doesn't want us to know.
Well, what is the approach you're taking with your own kids?
I have a 9-year-old daughter, and I started talking with her about what I expect her to be, what God expects her to be, and telling her how she is very beautiful the way God created her, and that beauty she needs to save for her husband. And as you said, we have to go on the assumption that we are going to keep them pure, but we also have to treat them as human beings and not let them know that if they do make a mistake, they can still come to us.
Well, yes, and you know, that's true of any sin, though, isn't it? I mean, we need to be very clear about what our expectation is and the consequences of falling short of that expectation. But then, you know, if our child were to shoplift or to be caught in a lie or any number of other things, we would certainly continue to love them. But somehow when it comes to the issue of sex, people talk about acceptance in a whole new way. You know, we would not accept shoplifting. We would still love the child and want to deal redemptively with that problem. But, you know, John, I'll just tell you the truth. I agree with you about parental responsibility here being the big issue. I agree that we need to encourage parents to think about opting their kids out of these programs. And to me, that's an even minimal response in many ways to this. But I think we also have to just be very clear that when we talk about these expectations, we really mean them. And, of course, we better speak with integrity and not give a double message. Appreciate your call, John. There's still time for you to call. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Again, just looking at this article from U.S. News and World Report, there are some absolutely amazing things put in here. According to this news article, 75% of American parents want schools to take a comprehensive approach that covers abstinence along with birth control, including abortion, sexual orientation, how to use condoms, dealing with pressures to have sex, and emotional consequences. You know, I just don't believe that, to tell you the truth. At least I don't believe that parents who may have responded positively to that question understood what was being asked of them. You know, there are clearly some hard issues here, and when it comes to public policy, we have to have some sympathy with the people who would have to try to come up with a position that would please all Americans. That's the problem, isn't it? In the midst of this cultural worldview conflict, there's no way to please everyone. So it comes down to another question, and that is this. Why would we expect the public schools to be the teachers of morality on these issues to children? I mean, are we outsourcing parenthood and outsourcing morality and outsourcing teaching to such a degree that the public schools are not only expected to teach the disciplines of, reading and writing and arithmetic, but now everything having to do with marriage and lifestyle and relationships? And what kind of teaching, what would it be? What kind of form would it take? Well, just consider if the issue of sexual orientation is covered. In these comprehensive programs, it is. But you have to know that it would be in such a way that it would present such options positively as lifestyle choices. As a matter of fact, this U.S. News and World Report cover story quotes Ron Schittler, who of parents, families, and friends of lesbians and gays as PFLAG, who said this, "The fact is kids' self-identity as gay or lesbian, whether we like it or not, that's coming, that about 9% of high school students say they are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or questioning." He goes on and says, "Gay kids, just as straight kids, are figuring out these new things that are happening in their heads and in their bodies. They need information." They need what kind of information? Let's go to Joe, a public school teacher from St. Petersburg, Florida, calling, listening on WTBN. Joe, what do you think of all this?
Well, I agree with you 100%. I've been blessed to send my kids to a private school since kindergarten. And I've been fortunate enough to teach them my views on sex and what's God's view on it. And I see in the public schools that they're so freely teaching and allowing, you know, not only boys and girls, but girls with girls. And they're just turned the other way. But mainly it comes back to the parents. You mentioned expectations. I think if your children know clearly your expectations on anything, whether it's sexual or any other kind of sin, and you live that as well in your life, that you know you're going to hedge your bet on being successful in that area.
Joe, let me ask you a question. As a public school teacher, have you seen a major shift in this whole focus on sex education in recent years?
I've only been teaching for 2 years, so I haven't been around enough to really see what was going on. And I do teach a vocational class at a high school here. But just the teachers, that the majority of them don't speak out and turn the other way with, again, the progression with these kids experimenting in the same sex and stuff of that nature.
Yeah, and Joe, we know a lot of that's going on, and in fact, it's being encouraged by some of these educators and in some of these curricular programs, and that's a truly scary thing. You know, what is happening in these sex education programs is that the worldview set loose in the sexual revolution of the 60s is now becoming institutionalized in the sex education curricular programs of our own day. And our children are being, they're really being treated as lab rats in a great social experiment. It's a moral disaster. I can't think of any way you can overestimate this problem. And we as parents, we have to take responsibility. And churches need to help parents know how to do this. I'll be right back with some final thoughts. This is Albert Mohler. Folks, you know, one of the big issues of the sex education question is that we're really seeing children treated like adults. We're really seeing them prematurely exposed to all kinds of information. And that's exactly the way some of these proponents of comprehensive sex education would have us to think. We should think of them as autonomous little human beings who should make their own decisions without that kind of outside interference that would come from oppressive parents with their Christian convictions, etc. Well, folks, push back against the spirit of the age. And fulfill your responsibility. But also be aware that the sex education issue is only one issue in which this premature treatment of children as adults is a temptation to us. The New York Times has a fascinating article in yesterday's edition. It's entitled, "New Rites of Passage, Struggling Toymakers Push Electronics for Preteens." And it has to do with the fact that that kids aren't really so interested in toys anymore. I mean, when I was a kid, it was about toys. You know, when I was a preteen, it was about model cars, and it was about bikes, and it was about all kinds of things that were fun and games. But now it's about electronics, and the major toy manufacturers are now partnering with electronics firms in order to market very sophisticated consumer electronics to very young children. And so this year, just in time for Christmas, you see cell phones marketed at six-year-olds, at kindergartners. You see the iDog Interactive Music Companion from Hasbro, which is for ages 8 and above. You have the TikTok cell phone with LeapFrog and Infora, a cell phone with LeapFrog educational games for ages 6 and up. And you have a video camera. It's called the Bratz Plugged-In Digital Video Camera, coming from MGA Entertainment for 6 to 12-year-olds. A Zoom box, a portable system that projects images from DVDs, video games, and digital cameras for ages 8 and above. Folks, I know an awful lot of adults who don't have any such things as these. And these game makers, toy makers, think that your kids should have all of these things wrapped up under the Christmas tree. Who is an 8-year-old who needs a digital projection system? Where in the world is the 6-year-old who needs a cell phone? I don't even think most six-year-olds do a very good job of talking on the phone. I think that's one of our parental challenges, is helping kids to talk on the phone. I call homes and I hear from six-year-olds and, for that matter, from 16-year-olds who just mumble into the phone and don't know how to talk. You're going to get them a cell phone? Folks, a little bit of sanity would remind us that it's not just sex education. We also need to be very careful about how our children are the targets of a consumer society that will sell them anything for a profit. You know, just say no is not just a message that should be directed at the kids, but at parents. When it comes to some of these products, as parents, let's just say no. They don't need it. They shouldn't have it. Even if the advertisers say they should want it, we're there to say, no, you don't. I'll join you next time for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.